And we have created a performance art piece that is about trying to get people to pay attention to the least funny thing on the planet, which is the pressures placed upon the planet by humans in all their capacity, from creating carbon emissions to creating toxins. So I won't go back to the whole history of this. It started off as a four-web metafictional piece. We thought we were so clever, and in fact it is brilliant, but nobody was going to the site, so what's the point, right? If we created the most amazing web piece ever and nobody's going to it, it doesn't matter. And so at some point we decided to start tracking, this was 4 years ago, we decided to start tracking daily news across the planet to see what was happening environmentally. And it took us about 2 or 3 months to decide that what we were doing was too clever, and that in fact what we needed to do was something that was more directly connected to what we were finding out every single day. So we created this new interface. And the epiphany that I had the last session was, we started this as a satire about the sensationalism associated with the apocalypse, the 2012 apocalypse. We started this as a satire of it. And now, after tracking the news, and I'm talking 6,000 articles, research papers, and whatnot, I'm here to tell you the apocalypse is real. So I no longer know what the point of the site is, except that it keeps me going to find articles every single day, except yesterday when I was in the Everglades having a really good time. It keeps me alert, and it keeps me awake to the perils of the planet. So what started out as something that was supposed to be a great fun time and we're really clever and blah, 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 actually has turned out to what I call a position of witness. That we're going to reach 7 billion people on October 31st. I posted that story just the other day. Did I say something funny about it is the question. This, I thought, was a particularly funny story. Climate change research is showing that flora and fauna is reducing in size in response. The scientist is responding, so I like the small world after all response there. So that's my epiphany. It started out as a satire, and now it's dreadfully real, and I don't exactly know what to do about it except to keep laughing, because, you know, the alternative is to cry, and crying's fine. I'm not saying crying's not fine. So I think that I've got some examples of things that I found that I think are hilarious ways to tell stories. Now, I'll run through those real quick, because I want to get to Stephanie, who's really proven the capacity to take these subjects and turn them into great entertainment and teaching products. But let's see here. Just a couple things. For you freelancers in a room that are looking for, you're looking to entice an editor or publication with your humor writing, you don't have to be a funny writer to do it. All you have to do is find a funny subject. Now, how many people know the Yes Men?
Yes.
A lot of Yes Men. Okay. These people are hilarious, and you can always do a great story about a Yes Men performance art piece. Hi. Now, this is a kind of story that would probably write itself. And let's see, if we run out of stuff to do, we'll go back to this window and play the YouTube. Because I know y'all just want to just watch movies, don't you?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, 30 seconds.
30 seconds of it? Okay.
Click that arrow.
The people have spoken. And I can make the window bigger if you want, but I won't know how to get back out of it, so. I've never watched this. I've only read it.
What a movie.
Rebecca, what if 3 minutes is just this scrolling thing? What will we
I'm
do?
A Star Wars generation. I'm automatically riveted.
That's right. I don't know if it's like if it's narrated and we're not hearing it.
I think this is. I think that's.
I think it's just like Star Wars.
This yeah.
Just
the,
you can't. You can't let it go now.
Oh, you're all riveted, aren't you?
I'm in suspense now.
Oh, there we go. Following teaches stunts before type professionals. Hold the microphone there. Near the sound that's coming out. It's not coming out.
Oh, it's
coming out of the speaker.
There you go.
Of course, Karl Orff. You've got to pull the Karl Orff in.
Oh my God.
All right, you got that one.
Oh my God. Superwoman
costume. That would be my excuse to wear my Wonder Woman costume.
Yes, your Wonder Woman costume, yes. Okay, so find something funny to cover and take your video camera. What could go wrong? You know, I have to say as an aside, why don't we just eat them?
They are fine.
The Asian carp are
a good thing to be raising in the sense that you know, you can feed them without some of the problems of doing something like feeding salmon or something like that. They will live fine.
Thank you. There's no reason not to eat Asian carp, right? I mean, I'm not for invasive species, except we're kind of invasive species ourselves, but otherwise, there's no reason. Okay, the other thing you can do is, as a writer, especially if you run the paper you write for, you can make up your own April Fool's story. So I made up a story about how, instead of fixing the potholes, the city developed an adoption process. You could adopt a pothole, and this poor woman, her dog fell down a pothole and it was lost. And so that was great fun for April Fools. Now, this is actually a particularly interesting story from the Hartford Advocate. And this is the last story I'll share right now. And it's really, I don't know why people do black backgrounds in websites. Actually, I've heard that they burn less energy, so all applause, but I find white type really hard to read. I just felt like this writer, whom I do not know, took the idea of having a lawn and basically how we give over our lives to keeping our lawn immaculate is ridiculous and is contributing to killing the planet all at the same time. This was a real inspiration to me. I'm going to kill my lawn in 2012. And so you can take a story that has an environmental impact and you can just take it like this writer did, basically from the position of almost like an alien coming at it from an outside perspective and saying, why do we have lawns? You know, the history of lawns. People who came to America first were trying to get away from oppression. You know that whole story, and they brought their lawns with them, symbols of the gentry. So it's really kind of ridiculous. So those are just some examples. I'm happy to share those ideas with you at any time after this. What I want to do now is ask Stephanie McMillan to take us through what she has created with Code Green and some of her other endeavors. And this is Stephanie McMillan. If you could just talk about yourself rather than me introduce you, that would be super.
Okay.
Thank you.
I started off, I was an activist for many years, and I would stand on street corners giving people leaflets as a way to try to reach people about the problems in our society. But if you hand somebody a leaflet and you say, capitalism's killing the planet, they just want to avoid your eyes, no eye contact, and they don't want to take the leaflet. So I came across this insight by Oscar Wilde, which is, if you want to tell people the truth, make them laugh, otherwise they'll kill you. So to try to be more accessible, I figured, you know, cartoons. That's sort of, I always have loved to draw. And I thought, oh, cartoonists, I, you know, find 20 papers to run my work and I can make a living, no problem. Of course, that's the hard part. But I have been drawing cartoons for 20 years now, and I've tried many different things. I have a lot of different projects going. But I'm going to share with you one that I started 2 years ago, which is a weekly editorial cartoon focused solely on the environmental crisis. And this past year, I won the Sigma Delta Chi Award for this from the Society of Professional Journalists. And it's been running in some magazines. Thanks. And some the local paper where I live in Fort Lauderdale, the South Florida Sun Sentinel, runs one every other week. So it's been doing pretty well. And it got in the Los Angeles Times a couple of times, and Yes Magazine, and other publications. So I'll run through a few of these. This is the very first one, and it also got in the Daily Beast, this one. The Secretary of the Interior noted that American children spend a daily average of only 4 minutes outside. Outside what? How much marketing do we need to save this situation? If you were a banker, I'd totally save you. The Master of Compromise, we must pass a climate bill. I don't care if it's the Democratic one that won't work or the Republican one that won't work. Several emails damage the credibility of data provided by 3 or 4 scientists out of the thousands who assert the proven dangers of global warming. Ha! I told you global warming was a hoax. So I target both the right crazy people who are global warming deniers and also, you know, people on the supposed left who aren't really addressing the problem in the way that it's really needed to be. This one is another one against the right wing. I mean, how many times have people said, oh, so much for global warming, look at all the snow. I mean,
or they
it's such
wish
a tired
for it too.
Cliche.
Jeez, I wish, where's global warming
yeah.
when I need it?
It's such a cliche, and it's like millions of people said that, and it just drove me crazy, so I had to draw a cartoon about it. the intellectual elites always try to confuse us with big words like average. But he was going from the other direction. The lifestyle environmentalist who just wants to be pure in their own life but isn't really looking around at what's around them. And I did some in German also. I went to Germany last year, and my cousin said, "Oh, you got to try to get in the German papers." So I got like 40 different German newspapers, and my cousins helped me translate like 10 of my cartoons, and I sent them out. None of them bought them, though, sadly. That was the one that didn't work. Here's another one in German, and here it is in English. "If we could gather the top executives of the major oil companies and related industries, plus their government regulators, and put all their heads together..." Oh, this is about the BP oil spill, by the way. "Then they could figure out the solution. No, we could use them to plug the well." "But without oil, we couldn't enjoy our comfortable and convenient way of life."
Yeah.
"This catastrophe will finally make everyone understand that our way of life is unsustainable." I think we need one more oil spill. The important thing is that you feel good about yourself. Another lifestylist. This one I did right after the Fukushima disaster. "Told you this technology is clean." Yep, cleaned out the whole area. And I heard, by the way, is it true that Turkey Point stood you guys up yesterday? You were supposed to go on a tour of Turkey Point, and that's what I heard. It was that they actually didn't allow the tour to happen.
I don't know. I didn't sign up for that one.
But they had a little incident a few weeks ago where one of their valves of their cooling liquid didn't open. And so maybe they were trying not to let anybody see that. "The sacred pact between capitalist and consumer. I'll slap on a green label and call it eco-something. I'll pretend to believe you so I can feel smug for buying it." "Look at that devastation, son. There's almost nothing left of the natural world. I'm counting on you to squeeze the last scraps of profit out of it." This is about factory-farmed chickens. "How can we ensure that these production units will supply safer products? Treat the chickens better. Pay regulators to further lower safety standards. And we know who's promoted.
Yeah.
"Hexavalent chromium was found in the drinking water of 89% of U.S. cities tested. Our lives are being sacrificed for the manufacture of stuff like chrome." Well, it is shiny. This one's about the Keystone tar sands pipeline that they're planning to build across all the way down the whole continent. "You have a choice, a job that will feed your kids for 3 years, building something that will kill them later, or starve now." How much later? Sort of the classic jobs versus the environment dilemma that I think is a false dilemma, because if we had not had our ways of subsistence stolen by the people in power in the first place, we wouldn't be forced to work for them and jobs wouldn't be an issue. "A Monsanto executive faces the apocalypse. The last wild plant on Earth. I must reach it." They have to follow their instincts, I guess. This is a cartoon I did for the Cartoon Movement, which is based in Amsterdam. And they're one of the few agencies that still pays well for their cartoons. This one was, they were doing a project for the UN where they were collecting cartoons about different proposals that the UN had had put together, and one of them was about reducing the rates of extinction, which have not been reduced. They're only increasing. And this is another one I did for them about censorship. And they put together a bunch of cartoons from around the world on censorship, and they've exhibited them in Amsterdam and Russia and Peru so far. Minimum Security is a comic strip that I do for Universal Press Syndicate, and it's 5 days a week, and it's about a group of friends who try to save the world from ecocidal maniacs. And so they try all these different strategies, and it's kind of like a thought experiment where people can try different things to save the planet and nobody actually has to get hurt. Like, they do the protest, they find out that doesn't work, so then they start doing sabotage, and they blow up a construction site, and they try all these different things so far nothing's worked.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's sort of a, let's see, let's play these things out in our minds so we don't actually have to do them in real life. We can see where they lead. And so the current story right now is one of the characters was standing in the street and an Occupy movement demonstration walked by and he got swept into it. So I don't know where that's going to go, though. But here's one. Canada banned plastic baby bottles containing the poison bisphenol A. Surely the U.S. will ban it, too. A U.S. official notes that Canadians are commie wimps. Here in the real America, we like our kids stupid and motionless, he said. It does not say that. The official added, baby bottles containing this valuable disciplinary aid are selling out due to high demand. This is a graphic novel that I co-wrote and illustrated with Derek Jensen, who wrote about 20 books on the environment, including Endgame and Language Older Than Words. And most recently, he worked on the book Deep Green Resistance with two other writers. This is an example of one of the pages. I won't read through the whole thing, but it's basically the story. There are three different storylines. One is that robots invade the Earth to eat it, and they pay the president gold bars, which are their waste product, to get permits to cut down all the forests so they can eat them. And meanwhile, these two little girls are trying to figure out will lifestyle changes help save the planet or not. And they figure out later that they don't. This is a cartoon I did for the New Internationalist magazine. I sometimes do like a full-page magazine-style piece. We must be the change we wish to see. That sounds so reasonable. We must be pure. We've already cut our consumption down to 3 cranberries per day. I'm sorting through all this trash, but it's not working. Recycle harder, damn it. Quick, switch to energy-efficient light bulbs. It's not enough. We need to stop industrial capitalism from destroying the planet. It's too dangerous to dissent. It's time to fight back. No, we'll get in trouble. And this is a cartoon that I did on request for somebody who was applying for a grant. He lives in a commune in Virginia, and he was applying for a grant to build windmills at the commune, and he thought a cartoon illustrating the benefits of windmills would help him in his grant proposal. I'm not sure if he actually got it, but I hope it helped. But this one's about how filthy coal is and how windmills save the day. And sometimes people hire me to do logos for them. So here are a couple of examples of that, of environmentalist radio show and distribution network. And Yes Magazine had me do this as an ad in their magazine to encourage people to go online instead of renewing by paper. So that's all I need to show. I have more if we run out of... Oops. Wait,
You had a little animation to show.
I would like to show that. It's very short. It's 30 seconds. But it's an animated version of one of the editorial cartoons. Oops. Where's the sound?
Up top.
Right there.
Yeah.
There.
Okay. You
have to
move
it. Oh, it didn't work.
You got to move the blue thing up. You got to click on the blue ball and pull it up.
Start over. Sorry.
Today, the Secretary of the Interior noted that American children spend a daily average of only 4 minutes outside.
So the Sun Sentinel took that one for their website as an experiment, and they said it did well in terms of viewers, but that they couldn't pay enough to keep it going because the animator required it was a lot of work for him. It takes him a couple of days to do it, so I didn't want to not pay him enough. So we ended up not doing any other ones. And I've run into that with a lot of cartoonists who have tried animation, is that cost-wise, newspapers are no longer willing to pay enough to make those happen. Anyway, that's... Should I go on, or should we
talk
more?
Well, let's see how everybody feels. First of all, thank you. So, what questions do we have for Stephanie about what she's creating? What did that spark in you? Anything to ask her? Certainly, one of the things that occurs to me seeing the animation is the cartoon, the static cartoon, I'll call it that, was funny. But with the beat in the animation, it makes it all the more. I wonder if that's more enticing to you as a cartoonist, to have that real-time ability to play with things like pauses.
It is. In fact, I studied animation in college, but it was the slow drawing kind. It was before they had computer animation. So when I worked with the animator, he didn't put the pause. And I asked him, like, can you just have him take a bite of the cookie first? And it worked much better at that.
Yes, exactly.
I think if you call Michael Moore, he'll have a bunch of good ideas for you.
Oh, I'm sure that's true. That's a good person who uses humor in an effective way. Yeah.
So any questions? I know I asked this before, if anybody had anything to share. Has this sparked any sort of memory of something that you've seen recently or read?
I have a couple that I've done.
Oh, please.
I've done a couple April Fools.
Yes.
And since we've seen that internet.
So he set this up. I write a blog on investing in clean energy stocks. So I've done two April Fools things so far. I'm trying to do it annually.
Okay, good. Now introduce yourself, please.
My name's Tom Conrad. And as I said, I write a blog about investing in clean energy. Okay, where's the...
There you go.
Firefox. And it'll take me a couple secs to find it. Now, it's very texty, so maybe I'll, like, pull it up and summarize.
Yeah, that'd be fine.
Go down to our archives and look for April. Okay, so this is my...
So this was April Fool's related?
I only do it on April Fool's.
Yeah.
It's pretty serious. It's normally a serious blog.
See, one day a year we get.
And there are a lot more work.
Not for me.
Okay, so.
I'd much rather make something up than have to actually call somebody for a quote. Are you kidding? And then verify it?
Okay, so this is... this was a spoof on Google's... E is less than RE program, where they are trying to, their whole initiative to make, RE is less than C, to make renewable energy cheaper than coal. And I was like, well, that's not good enough. So the point here was energy efficiency is already cheaper than coal. So I was making fun of it. Apple decided to get in the game and just said, oh, well, low. So it's a story about the rivalry between Apple and Google. I tried to sort of put in that Silicon Valley flavor of you're just not good enough to do this. It's spoof, it's very wordy, and mm-hmm. I could leave it up for a while.
Sure, yeah, absolutely. So what sort of response did you get to this?
Usually I don't get a ton of, I did get a couple comments saying, wow, that's funny. Two or three, which is about normal on my comments. Most of my comments usually are my normal stuff. It's someone wants to share something, ask questions about the company. This is different, but I definitely, this one, I think I got more response than the other one I did. This was, I got an email saying, good one, you made my day. Two or three.
Is this probably more responsive than usual or not?
About normal. I didn't, we just added, this might tell me something. We just added, there we go. Okay, so it got tweeted 17 times and shared twice on LinkedIn. which is pretty good considering we didn't have the buttons when I posted them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So this is, people did it.
Subsequent visits.
Oh, no, or they did it by themselves, but they had to manually do it. And so that's pretty good, because that's what we get now normally on a normal article with the buttons there.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that was pretty good. So I got more Sharon.
Thank you, Tom. Appreciate it. So this is how this was designed to work, this play shop, as I called it. So if you could, if anybody else has anything that they would like to share, that it is effective storytelling that you've seen about serious subject that is funny, or a serious subject that is...
If you sit up there, you get candy.
Well, just to keep it going, I was just thinking, this is not an environmental story, but I have to cover local politics in Indianapolis, and we've got a mayoral race coming up, and I just think the power of cartoons and collaboration can be fun, especially from a journalist perspective. It gets tricky sometimes when you introduce the humor attitude, but if there's an editorial cartoonist that you can work with, I think it's a good idea. So I asked our cartoonist to help me out with the mayoral spread, so he took on the Survivor theme. And these are our three mayoral candidates, you know, vying for action. And so when we got into the actual election guide itself, we have 25 districts within our city for city councilors, and that just gets overwhelming with text and idea when you have to meet all the candidates and understand what they're doing. So instead, we had them talk about what projects would benefit their district the most, and then we figured out what general themes were coming up, infrastructure, charter schools versus public schools, and then the cartoonist took off on those themes. So he's editorializing, but we've got some straight content with it, but it introduced some visual interest to help people take the fiber in their diet of, you know, understanding your local politics and hopefully getting involved. We have a terrible bus system, so we get the skeleton rotting, you know, at the bus stop. So I guess that's just my contribution.
Well, it's like in perfect show and tell style. You brought something to show and tell. Actually, if you don't mind, pass around.
I like
the room didn't see it.
And I'm sorry, the last cartoon of them, you know, like I never watched Survivor, but the counting the votes thing or getting around, or this is the side of the
room. Either way, just pass it around.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and speaking of Survivor.
Yeah.
It's kind of nice when the news throws you the funny thing itself. We had a guy named Rupert, who was a big Survivor person, and he's going to run as a Libertarian candidate for governor now. So at least we have that to play with.
Michael, you want to show yours?
Sure.
Well, the question I would have is, my discussions I was mentioning to you earlier, very convincingly, Randy, about how a visual or a picture is worth a lot of words, particularly, you know, to many people or most people, perhaps, as a convincing thing. And that, your example is a perfect one of that. But then I wondered, what actual evidence is exactly there is about that when it's on this topic? I mean, okay, I watch his movies he gave me, the Lock and Dodos or Sizzle. But, of course, that's speaking to the converted.
Yeah.
You know? The real question I would have is, you know, are the 75 or more percent of the country that you want to reach or feel that point of view taken seriously, even watching that, convinced by it, swayed by it, or it's irrelevant to them? I don't know the answer to that. I would love to know.
Yeah, there probably is, and I should have prepared the sort of statistics around whether, you know, something that's funny gets more attention. Actually, I was in a session earlier today. I thought one of the scientists from that panel was going to be in here, and she could probably give us some of those statistics about how humor can. I think we all know it on an anecdotal level, right? You know, are we
sensitive? It works convincing me. On these particular topics, I'd be convinced any of it. But in general, it's intuitively right.
Yes. And last year, I started off the session by showing Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert and The Onion. But I felt like you all know those people, and we know what they're capable of doing, how they're capable of reaching a larger audience.
But they have a benefit too.
Yes.
Because when you pick up a Bill Maher, you already know their intent. Mm-hmm. You pick up Maher and the cartoonists from the Herald.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You have an idea.
Yeah.
But when there's something as serious as the problems that this country has.
Yeah.
And then you hit them with a cartoon, their tendency is not to look for the funny aspect, unless you have a slug line. Pathos can be hubris or something like that. Because sometimes people are not going to, they might think it's funny, but it's not supposed to be funny. This is about a lengthy subject. Mm-hmm. There's challenges involved.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
And when you were looking into why you weren't read, you could have done an awful lot of funny things, but unless I turn and says, oh, there's Jim again doing his crazy stuff, I'm not tuned into you yet.
Yeah, yeah.
But am I making sense to you?
Yes, yes, you are. You are. And you mentioned pathos as well, which is why I'm glad that Michael has joined us. He has an example of pathos that I think is very powerful.
Is this Michael?
This is Michael.
Hello, Mike. Hey, how you doing?
Yourself.
So I'm just going to start by saying I grew up believing, although I never studied it, that the answer to our problems was for all of us to work, simply work. Most of our work would be to work to have a healthy place for all of us to live in every way, shape, and form. And I've heard a few statistics about the economics of that, and we've never really tried to do it, but it's still my belief to this day that that's the answer to our economic problems, is to work to have a healthy place for all of us to live. I don't think there's any other way. But anyway, I'm a marine mammal person. I work with blue whales mostly. And it was very interesting, as an intro to what I'm about to show you, there was just two very powerful dolphin people here in this room giving a fantastic hour and a half, Hardy Jones and Rick O'Barry, who made The Cove. And at one point, Hardy, who spent the better part of his life working on dolphins, made reference to a couple of films that he made that he put on YouTube that actually got 350,000 people to watch them over a course of probably a year or two. And you're about to watch a film that I put on YouTube just a few months ago that's had 4.25 million people watch
you?
It. Yes. So you're going to see it right now.
Celebrity.
And
500,000 of those hits are me.
Is it? Yeah.
Seriously, I saw this video about 5 months ago. I don't want to build up too much for it. That's always a problem. But when I realized I was randomly sitting next to him at the dinner on Wednesday, I asked him if I could hug him. And he said yes. Just letting you know, Michael's huggable.
Actually, I exaggerated. 4,228,332. Okay, here we go.
So just
a few minutes here, and then we can talk about it if you like. I pushed play. Let me push play again.
There it goes.
Oh. Okay, here we go. You got to do it that way. Okay, I got it. Here we go. Sound? I don't know. I don't hear it.
It comes in later. I can
just barely hear it over here.
Let's turn it up.
Yeah, let's go back.
Oh, it's doing that thing again, Riggs.
That's
it. Should be
a. Is it up? No,
yeah, you can barely hear it. Though.
You can amp it up on this.
Yeah, I think you turned up that.
Yes, it worked last time, didn't it? I'm waiting for them to discover that. Adam, last time I turned it up from that speaker, and it worked.
Mm.
Got it.
Oh, it's here on the table.
By the way, this part's not humorous.
Yeah.
This part is not humorous.
Here we go.
The irony can be humorous.
Is that good?
Thank you, Adam.
No problem.
Michael spends 2 months seeing quartets every winter, photographing blue, finback, and humpback whales, while tracking these magnificent animals across our oceans, while observing their complex behaviors in the wild. On Valentine's Day of 2011, Michael, his family, and a few friends were presented with a rare opportunity, a chance to save the life of a humpback whale. Their efforts were captured on film. Here's their incredible story.
Video as much as this is.
On Valentine's Day, while plying the waters of the Sea of Cortez, I came upon a young humpback whale that appeared to be dead. We floated next to the whale for several minutes, but we saw no signs of life. Suddenly, the whale rose slightly in the water and forcefully exhaled. I decided to ease into the water with my snorkeling gear in order to assess the situation.
Yeah.
I quickly discovered the whale was severely entangled in the gill net of the type used by local fishermen. As I swam alongside the animal, our eyes met. There were no words we could share, but I wanted to let the whale know that we were there to help. It took some effort to stay focused given the great emotion of the moment. The sight of this large and beautiful creature trapped and so close to death was almost overwhelming. And I must admit, I was a bit scared because I knew the whale was frightened and fatigued, but it could still kill me with one panicked movement. The situation was indeed bleak. The tail was entangled in so much gear it was weighted down a full 15 feet below the surface. Both pectoral fins were pinned to the side of its body, and the nylon gill net went all the way up the whale's back, forward of the dorsal fin. I made a bit of headway, but it seemed too great a task, so I went back aboard to radio. We were told that perhaps in an hour someone else would arrive, and we all knew that by then it might be too late. While I was working around the pectoral fin, my boatmates, George and Guerra, had managed to get some of the net pulled over the side of our ponga. I came back aboard, and we pulled and cut the net as fast as we could. We were maneuvering the boat into proper position with a paddle and only had one small knife, but after great effort managed to free one of the pectoral fins. Sensing a spark of freedom, the young whale started to swim, taking us on a Nantucket sleigh ride through the Sea of Cortez for about a half of a mile. The whale eventually tired and came back up right underneath us. We continued to grab more and more net and haul and cut, and after nearly a half hour, the other pectoral fin came mostly free. And when the whale tired, we began cutting the net off the powerful tail fluke. Oh my God, the fluke is upside down now. The whale is trying to sail. Finally, after about an hour of exhausting work, we decided we had enough net aboard to make the final cut. We were hoping enough net was off the fluke to free her.
Call is free.
She slowly swam away, but about 500 feet from our boat, she breached high into the air. I cleared all the net from underneath the boat, and we headed off, five tired but exhilarated people, with a boat builder and nylon net. For the next hour, she provided us with an incredible full-surface display. We saw at least 40 breaches, as well as tail lobs, tail slaps, and pectoral fin slaps. We all believed it was at least a show of pure joy, if not thanks. We followed her for about 4 miles over the next hour and said goodbye. Needless to say, we were all proud and thrilled that we saved this fantastic young life. It was an incredible experience that none of us will ever forget.
Did you get a little lucky? Michael and I moving.
So, I'm not exactly sure how that relates to everything that we're talking about here, but it probably does in some way. Just as a follow-up, my lesson here is that I've learned when you emotionally connect with your audience, whether it's 15 people or 7 billion people, you're going to get a lot further with what you're trying to accomplish than if you don't emotionally connect with your audience. And it is my belief that the way to get the most people behind working on improving or saving the ocean, which is critically important on this planet, is to use the most powerful voices that we have for the ocean. And those voices are clearly the whales. There's no doubt that dolphins and coral reefs and sea turtles and seals and many other things have strong voices. But I think there's no dispute that the whales have the strongest voices and the most effect on us of everything in the ocean. So I'm currently working on trying to do we've got a shot at it too, trying to do a documentary film on the subject of whale disentanglement. And there is some very powerful hidden footage of disentanglement that exists that I've seen, and some incredible stories. There's reasons why that footage hasn't come out. A lot of it has to do with our Marine Mammal Protection Act in this country. In fact, just another footnote here, the video that you just saw, if I had released that video and that disentanglement occurred in U.S. waters, I'd have been thrown in jail. Not fined, locked up.
Why?
That's illegal to do in the United States.